Good morning and welcome back to day two of the Standing Advisory Group meeting. I wanted to say thank you for all your insightful and thoughtful comments yesterday during the breakout sessions. For the next hour, we're going to provide a summary as to the comments we heard and the thoughts that were expressed. And we're going to do it by actually dividing up by the three different breakout groups. So you'll hear a summary from Group A, a summary on Group B, and then on Group C. And afterwards, we will open up to the floor for additional thoughts and comments on the auditor's reporting model. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Marty so he can provide the summary on what happened in his breakout group.
Thanks, Bella. We thought about the last evening trying to combine the comments into one organized report, but there actually were some differences in each of the groups that we thought were important enough to bring out. So while you'll hear some repetition, listen carefully, because I think there's some interesting subtleties between the different groups in what different people thought about the issues that were being addressed. Group A, we had a very lively dialogue, and I think that was the case throughout the groups. We're going to talk about this in really two major topics, the first being the content of the auditor's and form of the auditor's report, basically the pass-fail model, and whether or not it should include additional information about the financial statements or the audit. And then the second subject is really around fraud, and should there be more information in the report to explain the auditor's responsibility around fraud. So those are the two general topics and lots of subjects below that. In Group A, there was overall support for the existing pass-fail model. So basically, I think trying to change that and put too much more into that report, I think there's a general feeling that that could confuse investors. So if something were going to be done, it would be more in the case of an addendum to that report, such that investors would still understand whether or not the financial statements presented fairly or not. The group suggested possible means of providing more relevant information through two different ways. One, the auditor's discussion and analysis, and I'll talk about that in a moment, or two, expanding and increasing the use of the explanatory paragraph that already exists at the auditor's discretion to highlight areas of interest to investors, such as higher risks, valuation issues, et cetera. So there was some support for using the existing tools in place, which aren't used that often, for matters of emphasis to bring to the shareholders' investors' attention. With respect to the supplementary or addendum to the audit report, as some have called it, the auditor's discussion analysis, I would say there were just pretty diametrically opposed views. There were some who thought, largely in the investor camp, that was a very good idea, and that's what we've been asking for, and we want to receive that. And I'd say basically all others generally thought that wasn't a great idea. Those who thought it was a good idea thought that such an addendum could provide more information to investors on the auditor's assessment of critical, challenging issues faced in the audit. The investors are interested in the auditor's judgment and their assessment process, and the addendum could provide that. The addendum could provide investors insights into the audit committee's discussions regarding the key issues, key risks, key concerns that both the auditor and the audit committee were worried about. And then some thought also that document, the AD&A, would ultimately provide auditors with more leverage to force better disclosures in the financial statements, the thought there being that at the end of the day, the preparer probably wouldn't want a lot of information in the AD&A that wasn't in the financial statements, and that over time they'd start to converge in that information. The auditor wouldn't need to include it in the AD&A if it wound up being included in the footnotes, if you will. So those who saw that sort of pro that it would just basically force change to improve disclosures by having that tool to report other matters if they weren't disclosed in the financial statements. Those who were opposed to it thought that such a report would further blur the line between the auditor's and management's responsibilities. And they thought that if additional information is needed about ranges or estimates or whether or not somebody's at a low end of a range and those types of, you know, qualitative disclosures, they believed that FASB or the SEC should be providing the requirements such that that type of information is disclosed in the footnotes. So if something is missing about information that investors need around risks, ranges, or more qualitative information, then that should fall into the hands of FASB and the SEC to create that disclosure requirement so that it's in the footnotes. Some of the cons also were that such information, like the information provided to the audit committee, could be taken out of context and misinterpreted by users. Again, the thought there is, and it was mentioned probably in some of the dialogue here also, that many of these types of matters could be discussed between an auditor and the audit committee over some time. There's greater understanding of what's going on in the business often, even company jargon, whatever it might be. But trying to take that out of context and putting it in a supplemental report could be misinterpreted by investors as to what it means. Legal liability issues were raised by some of the auditors as to the judgment of what to put in such a supplemental report, who would provide the guidance for that, and second guessing about what was put in and what was not put in without good standards and rules around that would create liability issues. And others just thought that at the end of the day it was just non-operational, that over time it just wouldn't work really. So, again, I think it was divided into two camps, with the investors and investor-type representatives who were sitting in the room feeling that this was a good thing to do, and all others feeling that there were too many obstacles in the way of it. There was a suggestion to have the auditor's report refer to specific footnote disclosures, as there would be more focus then on disclosures. Actually, the reference would be that the audit opinion would include a statement with respect to the disclosures in the footnotes, just as it says that the financial position of the company and results of operations and cash flows, and more emphasis in the opinion on the related disclosures presenting fairly. With respect to information about the auditor's procedures, some have said, from time to time we hear that people want to hear more about, well, what did the auditor do? So with respect to providing information in the audit report about more information about the audit procedures, we tested fair values, we did this or that with respect to inventory, I think generally we're not supportive. I think most understood that there's a wide body of auditing standards, and it would be pretty hard to pick and choose as to which one of those standards was more important to reference in the report. And so, therefore, that was generally not perceived to be of great value, and so there wasn't much support for that. With respect to the subject of varying degrees of assurance, that was also not supported. However, having said that, some were concerned that there are varying degrees of assurance with respect to just the information in the financial statements in general, a greater degree of certainty of the value of certain assets versus other items such as highly illiquid financial instruments, which are more difficult to value. So there is a different degree of certainty on values within the financial statements. And some suggested that both we at the PCOB and auditors should be pushing back somewhat on the standard-setting process, the accounting standard-setting process, if we think information is becoming unauditable, and that the profession and the board should be considering those sort of things and having a dialogue with the standard setters about what information is being required under accounting frameworks and whether or not that information is actually auditable. On the second matter, with respect to the auditor's responsibility regarding fraud, there was a fairly general agreement that the auditor's report could be improved. As we mentioned yesterday, the audit report right now says that the audit provides reasonable assurance that the financial statements are free of material misstatement, and it doesn't mention the sentence that goes on in the standard itself, which is due to error or fraud, and so the word fraud isn't even mentioned. So there was general agreement to add to that phrase a reasonable assurance that the financial statements are free of material misstatement, whether due to error or fraud. And I thought reasonable agreement that adding another sentence, which would say reasonable assurance, although not absolute, is a high level of assurance. So I think that on both sides of the equation, I think there was a general thought that, yeah, there is a problem in terms of investors understanding responsibility for auditors' responsibility for fraud, and that adding this language, which basically comes out of the standards, could improve that. With respect to the auditor's responsibility regarding the detection of fraud, there wasn't any strong belief that there was a need to change the auditing standards, generally not supportive of changing the standards regarding the responsibility to increase it in some way or raising the level of assurance with respect to doing forensic type of audits every 2 or 3 years or forensic procedures annually. It was noted that certainly the existing fraud standards indicate that when certain risks are noted as part of a fraud risk assessment, that forensic procedures should be performed as part of an audit under existing standards. But that's, of course, when circumstances dictate such a risk is there. So that was noted, and people were aware of that. So with that, I think that's a summary of comments in Group A. Anybody have any questions about that summary? If not, we'll move to the others and get discussion after all the groups. But I will pause for a moment. Okay. Group B was Barbara Vanich.
Thank you, Marty. Good morning. Group B spent most of our breakout session really discussing how the current report could be enhanced and to be responsive to investor wants. The benefits we identified of the current model were that it's consistent and simple, and in general there seemed to still be support for the pass-fail model. While we didn't list any specific shortcomings of the current model, there was acknowledgement that if customers, or better said investors, are not happy with the current model, it does merit considering how it could be improved. Before I summarize the enhancements we discussed, I did want to mention a few important thoughts our group had on what it is exactly that investors are looking for. A comment was made that consideration should be given to needs versus wants of investors, or said another way, what information could be included in the auditor's report that might change an investor's decision to buy or sell a company's stock. Some of the matters that we believe investors may want may better be dealt with outside of the auditor's report, as they stem from concerns regarding current disclosure requirements, how an audit is actually conducted, and how audit committees are or are not currently keeping investors' best interests at hand. It was suggested that we consider having a focus group on this topic, which would include investors, preparers, and auditors to further refine what exactly it is that investors want. Moving on to the enhancements of the current reporting model, while there wasn't always consensus, there was varying levels of support for including in the report more potentially on the coverage of balances achieved during the audit, including more on who performed the auditor work, and also including areas of focus which might align with the critical accounting policies identified by management, along with procedures performed in these areas. With respect to whether or not to provide information similar to that to provide the audit committee, our group had more polarized views. The pros discussed were that this type of information is something that investors currently say that they want, and the cons of including this included that it might not be useful or could even be misleading to an investor who doesn't have the context of the discussions held with the audit committee, especially those that occur during the private sessions. Regarding the form of the report, there was not much support for including additional information in the emphasis paragraph or going to a more free-form report. With respect to requiring a supplemental auditor discussion and analysis, there were, again, mixed views similar to those of communicating matters which are communicated to the audit committee. Some additional concerns raised with an auditor discussion report would be the requirement of the auditor's personal judgment in developing the report, which would really influence what was discussed. Number two, how you would address disagreements that could arise between management and the auditor in considering this report, and that it might further blur the lines between management and auditor responsibilities. There was no overall support for reporting varying levels of assurance, and as far as the grading of audits, while interesting, was not viewed as being operational. On the fraud issue, there was no objection in including the language, whether caused by fraud or error language, in the auditor's opinion. And the concept of reasonable assurance was also pretty much agreed on by the group, as long as it was used to describe both the auditor's responsibility for fraud and for error, and not just fraud. There was no support for requiring a forensic audit. The cost-benefit ratio just doesn't seem to be there, and it would also seem punitive to some people in nature. And I think similarly to what Marty said about Group A, it was generally the consensus that the current procedures required regarding fraud are currently adequate. And another thing to point out was not we should try to stay away from the term forensic, just because it had such negative connotations, or maybe expensive connotations. Thank you.
In Group C, we had a lot of discussion around the additional information that could be provided to meet the users' needs, the customers, which were described to be the investors. People seemed to like the pass-fail model, but they agreed that the information in the report potentially could be improved. There was agreement that in terms of additionally describing the auditors and management's responsibility, that there wasn't a need to do so, that the current report described it in enough detail. People also didn't think that describing the audit committee's responsibilities was not the right place to do that in the auditor's report. Individuals also did not think that we needed to describe the procedures the auditors perform as they conduct their audit, and that would basically, if you were to do so, that would basically describe all of the accounting standards, all of the auditing standards that the auditors use when they perform an audit. The majority of discussion did focus on a lot of this additional information that the investors are looking for, and trying to figure out what would be the best way to provide that to the investors. We discussed that the audit committee is an agent and a steward of the investors, but the investors are looking for more information than what is currently being described in the auditor's report. Specifically, they're looking for the auditor's perspective on the significant critical judgments and significant estimates and significant account issues. They value the auditor's opinion, and they would use that information to make informed decisions when investing in a particular company. They understood that the additional information relating to accounting information, that the right place for that was in the financial statements and in the disclosures. And if they needed additional information regarding the actual company accounting information, that should be located in the financial statements. We did discuss the potential of having something similar to a scorecard of where you would rank something from a very aggressive policy to a conservative range of a policy. People weren't looking for something that they understood they couldn't, whatever it was, couldn't be very verbose and voluminous, that there would have to be a potential way to somehow summarize it and concise it. The issue was is that the auditors and the issuers, the auditors and the audit committees have a very robust relationship, and trying to figure out a way of how, what information could they provide without having a chilling effect on that relationship, because that relationship is supposed to enhance the audit and is supposed to really dive into the critical areas and the high-risk areas. People were concerned that if you started to put that information in writing and put it in the public arena, that that would have a chilling effect and would stop that communication, and that that is the most important thing, is for that communication to still keep going. And so trying to figure out a way of how to put that together and also provide enough context that the user who may not know the, some of the background information that the audit committee and the auditor would know when they're having a discussion, how could you do that and how feasible would that be? People discussed that the audit committee and the auditor have a certain base of knowledge regarding the insights of that company, and that if they were to use the same information, that the user may not be able to understand because they don't have that inside information, because they just don't know the company in the same depth as the auditor and the audit committee. So we did talk a lot about the practicality of putting this together. But what did come out of it is that people were willing to work with each other and trying to come up with a solution on how to provide investors and users of the financial statements and the audit report the information that they are seeking, the auditor's perspective. I don't think we had consensus as to what the solution was, but there seemed to be a lot of agreement from what I could tell, that people were willing to work with each other to get there. There was a discussion of where this possibly could be a mutual project, of where the FASB would work on the disclosures and other parts relating to the financial statements and the disclosures. You know, there would be some work done relating to audit committees, and then at the same time, we would be working on the auditor's report. And if all three kind of work together, that we may be able to come up with a solution that would be appropriate for everybody. There was actually one discussion as to who should provide this information, in sense of should it be the audit committee that should make this information public rather than the auditor. And I don't think the issuers were thought that was very feasible. We did have the same liability issue that came up in terms of how this information would impact the auditor's liability if it was part of the auditor's report or something that was an addendum. In terms of the form versus content, I think people were most concerned about the content and less concerned about the form that it would take. So I think there was – people were slightly leaning toward having an addendum, but we spent more of our – most of our discussion in terms of what that content would be. The as it relates to the varying level of insurance, we had similar thoughts that – at this point, we don't need varying levels of assurance. I think it was, you need to look at the accounting standards first and work on that before you start working on the auditing standards and how that would present the level of assurance. So I think people are looking for more transparency because, as Marty mentioned, that there are different line items that have fair value versus and varying degrees of ranges, and how can we provide information to the public in general that would be useful to them, and where should that come from? In terms of the discussion relating to fraud, people seem to agree that we need to clearly state what an audit is and what an audit isn't as it relates to the auditor's responsibility. As it relates to fraud, people agree that adding the additional language would be helpful, that language being due to error fraud, the material misstatements due to error fraud, and that reasonable assurance is a high-level assurance but not absolute assurance. People wanted that language to be concise and clear. They didn't need want it to be verbose. Someone did mention that we should consider possibly including that the financial statements are free of material misstatement due to error or fraud also in the opinion paragraph. So instead of just saying present fairly, that we would potentially look to including that language in the opinion paragraph. In terms of changing the standards relating to fraud, we had several suggestions of looking to possibly what the fraud center would look at when it is up and running at the PCAOB. And then more specifically, a couple of line items of auditors should be looking at the whistleblower information, anonymous letters, and that should be part of their engagements right now. And also looking at the short selling, analyzing the short sellers and seeing how that could potentially provide some risk analysis. But there wasn't any, I think, thought to overhaul the current fraud AU 316 standard or make the auditor's responsibility for fraud higher. We did talk about that the auditors already do have the capability to elevate to fraud procedures, forensic procedures, during a regular audit under AU 316, and that I think there was general agreement that you don't need to have a forensic portion of an audit on every audit. We did talk about some of the instances of where is it a standard issue, where a standard needs to be amended, or is it a practice problem, meaning are there already things in the auditing standards the auditor should be doing as it relates to fraud and analyzing unusual journal entries versus if there's something that needs to be enhanced. And so that was something I think that we think about relating to all of our standards. I think that pretty much sums it up as we have the discussion in Group C. I think what I would like to do now is open it up to the floor. You were all part of each one of these groups and seek your additional thoughts and comments relating to this topic on anything that you heard just now in the summary or any additional thoughts that you may have that you think the board that would assist us in determining on how to move forward on this topic. Doug Carmichael.
So, since there was general agreement, it seemed, on the auditor's conceptual responsibility for detecting fraud and on adding language to the report, I would encourage the board to do that and not wait for any wholesale other changes in the audit report. I'm reminded that when the board changed the wording from generally accepted auditing standards to standards of the PCAOB in the standard audit report, it went very quickly. Didn't consume a lot of time. And I think that this would be a very worthwhile change to make in the report. I do think that the discussion captured the changes that should be made, although I do like the idea of adding that phrase to the opinion paragraph as well. I think that would also clarify things. But those are changes that could be made relatively quickly. That would bring about, I think, a big improvement. I would also encourage you, though, to think on the standards. I think there was consensus that there doesn't need to be any change in responsibility or addition of new procedures at this point to the existing fraud standards. But I think that there are people that are still confused and believe mistakenly that the presence of collusion or falsified documentation automatically get the auditor off the hook, they reduce the auditor's responsibilities rather than that the auditor's responsibility remains the same to obtain reasonable assurance. And I do think that would be worth clarifying. Also, some people seem to confuse falsified documents, which the auditor can't authenticate, and falsification of the accounting records, which is something that the auditor, of course, should authenticate by auditing and establishing the propriety and accuracy of. And I think that could probably be done as part of the risk assessment standards. And I would, again, encourage not making it a long, drawn-out project when you can make quick changes, because I think the history is that quick changes that people generally are in agreement about can be made without consuming a lot of the board's resources.
Thank you, Doug. Neri?
An observation and a question. In the spirit of what Doug just said and in the context of low-hanging fruit, one thing that strikes me as important, and I don't think we've placed significant emphasis in the discussion, is the notion of disclosures and the emphasis of disclosures within the report. I think it's implicit. I think everyone understands it, but it's not explicit both in the report and, in my view, in understanding or perception of the actual audit work. So in the spirit of low-hanging fruit and a quick win, I think this could be another element that's worthwhile exploring beyond the broader root canal of modifying the entire report with an addendum. The other question is the notion of who signs the report. My understanding was some dialogue about who will sign the report, whether it's the firm, the individual partner, or the other. Is this part of this project? Would this be handled independently?
We actually have a separate project on signing the auditor's report, and we issued a concept release last year, and we're analyzing comments, and we'll be going to the board with a recommendation on how to proceed with that project.
But I do see them closely attached, that it would be logical if we were making the changes that Doug suggested seem to be relatively easy to make, and if we concluded that this was also an appropriate matter, it seems they could go together. But the second one, as Bella said, is in my office right now, our office, we are analyzing all of the various aspects of the comments as well as other developments in other countries, and we'll be making a recommendation to the board as to how we think the board should proceed in this matter in the near term. And we'll do likewise with respect to the audit report.
Gary?
Back on the comment about including the phrase whether caused by fraud or error, just help me know, what stops the firms from just doing it now? I mean, do you have to follow the prescribed standard report in your literature? I mean, if there seems to be general agreement to the room, that's a good thing to do. So do you actually need rulemaking to do it? Why couldn't it just happen right now?
I probably need to think some more about that question, but I'm pretty sure that the form of the report is spelled out in the auditing standards, and the form of the report does not include that language. And I think departing from the form of the report today would probably be, in my view, is probably not appropriate. But
I'm just asking because in theory you can have an emphasis paragraph, you can have a qualified paragraph. So there's an ability to amend it, and I appreciate this is probably much better done by rulemaking, but your agenda is busy unless you can quickly put this out. It just strikes to me as you could just do it, but I'll defer to that it's inappropriate against the standard report in your literature.
I think the emphasis paragraph is different, but I think, auditors tinkering around with various aspects of the standard report by either adding something or deleting something, I think would probably not be in the best interest. So I think my understanding, and I'd have to explore this further with discussions with general counsel, is that, the basic form of the report, other than the emphasis paragraph, should follow the prescribed format.
Doug Carmichael.
The content of the report is specified in the standards as requirements. And so I think it would be definitely advisable to add it in the standard making. The way that the words are arranged is not required. And as anyone that's seen PricewaterhouseCoopers reports knows, you don't need to follow the standard order in the paragraph. So there is a distinction there. There's a separate listing in the standards of the content things that must be covered in the report. And the way that those are arranged and presented in the report is flexible.
And Gary, just to follow up on it, in the back of the briefing paper, we have a description of all the items that need to be part of the report. And under AU 508, paragraph 8, it kind of stops at free of material misstatement. It doesn't have that additional wording. And so because it doesn't have that additional wording, that's why we would need to think about that.
No, that's fine. Just an observation. What hit me, I got it.
Charlie Niemeyer.
Thank you. Yeah, coming into this and not being a part of the Treasury Committee recommendation process, I guess I focused on this as being an expectation gap type of concern. And I guess just the process that I've been involved with so far with this, it seems to me that I would label this less as being an expectation gap. It seems that we have a general consensus as to the level of responsibility of the auditor, but more of a satisfaction gap. And, you know, I think investors are not satisfied with the status quo. And, you know, I think this is justified considering that disclosure of financial reporting problems tends to come after the fact too often. And as long as that continues, I think this satisfaction gap will exist. And whether it's addressed in the auditor's report or elsewhere, I think it's something that's not going to go away. And so I want to make sure that, and when we talk about this, at least in my mind, I'm changing my focus as being an expectation gap problem and more about a satisfaction gap problem.
Thank you, Charlie. Anybody else have any thoughts? Well, I guess we can. Oh, Jim Schnur.
Just a question. One of the groups you said kind of agreed that it would be good for the investors and the auditors to get together. Have you thought about how that might happen to work out, you know, a suggested way forward?
I think that's a good question. I think since yesterday evening until this morning, we probably haven't thought that through. But I did note that difference in one group compared to the others. And I thought in at least two of the groups, it sounded more polarized, that we just don't think it's operational, this addendum, and don't think it's really workable, was the view of some, whereas those who were advocating an investor's point of view said this is really needed. But there didn't seem to be a way forward that came out of the group. I did hear from one of the groups that reported that both sides, those who were more supporting an investor's point of view and those who were thought of the, you know, auditor's or preparer's point of view, said, yeah, it sounds like this issue's been around long enough and people are asking for more and investors are the customers and let's sit down at a table somehow and figure out how to solve this matter. So I think that that's a good idea. I do think, as Bella said, it probably includes some of it is improved disclosures requirements out of FASB if the disclosure framework project includes some additional information. But beyond that, it's probably a good subject for some kind of a, you know, working group, some sort of forum that we could organize at the PCOB with various constituencies to discuss it. So I think we have to think that through, but I think some open kind of meeting for further discussions around this sounds like at least that group thought that would be a really good idea to let's work through it and come to some solution.
Jennifer, did you have something to add?
I just wanted to comment that in Group B, the recommendation was not just investors and auditors, but also preparers and have focus groups to really try to solicit different views. And I guess going to Charlie's point on satisfaction gap, Group B really talked about trying to get to the root cause of the problem. Is it the audit report the solution to the problem, or is it other auditing standards? Just auditors should do more? Is it reside in the accounting standards? Is it the audit committee's role? It's, you know, kind of different elements, but trying to engage other parties, not just the auditors and investors.
Barbara Roper.
This was actually my suggestion, so I'm glad Marty thought it was a good idea. The issue that I was trying to get at here is that these, it seems to me that these discussions tend to happen on a really sort of abstract level. So we have survey data where we don't really, we can't really tease out what the issue of concern is. And then we have people at the table like me who sort of have a theoretical grasp, but I'm not one of the people who's going to be sitting there with detailed understanding of what I want, what someone might want from the report that they're not getting now, and that there would be a benefit to getting really the key people who, the most sophisticated investors who want this information into a room with the issuers, with the auditors, with the PCAOB, and start walking through in very specific fashion what is it that you want and how do we get that information? Is it something that is solved through the accounting standards? Is it something that's solved through the audit report? You know, where is the solution to the problem? Because I am not convinced that all of the dissatisfaction is with the report itself, but I think, you know, I think it's with a broader range of issues, some of which involve the financial statements, some of which involve a lack of confidence in the audit committee, some of which involve a lack of confidence that the audit is being performed with adequate diligence. So I think if you could get into the room and get people to get specific, as opposed to just responding to some survey question or whatnot, and really talk through the issues, you might find that there are concrete issues that could be dealt with fairly easily one way or the other.
Thank you, Barbara. Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I would support the idea of a focus group or some further meetings on this. In my mind, it's pretty clear that investors believe that there needs to be some better communications between the external auditor and investors. And I think they believe that there's a lot of benefits to that, including improving the quality of financial reporting, assist them in investment decision-making, and also at a growing number of public companies, they're required to vote on the external auditor every year. They need additional information to make an informed vote, and so it can also be helpful in that regard. But I support Barbara's idea of having further discussions on the types of information that would be helpful to investors so that we can have this improved communication with the external auditor that investors are looking for. Thank you.
Jeff, just as a follow-up, would you support, though, Doug's comment to try to separate this more detailed information, the addendum, if you will, project from what Neri described and as low-hanging fruit and what Doug described as certain matters that he thought there was general agreement on, such as adding language about due to error or fraud, and that reasonable assurance is a high level of assurance that those sort of separating the project into maybe a short-term component and the longer term that the focus groups would work on?
I don't think I have any objection to that. As long as we are proceeding down a road to try to enhance the communication between the external auditors and the users of the financial reports.
Thanks very much.
Arnold Schindler.
Thank you. I found this discussion also yesterday very interesting because in the IAASB we have exactly a similar project, as you know, and we discussed it at some length in the December board meeting, and you have referred in your document to the underlying documents for that board meeting, which Jennifer attended. So we are also faced with the question how to take this from here. We also discussed it in our advisory group a month ago, and also there we concluded that it would be very beneficial to have further dialogues with investors and preparers and auditors. So I was in Group B, and I thought it was a very useful suggestion to have these focus groups, and we are thinking about those. So I thought I should know that, and the more we can coordinate and make that an efficient process rather than duplicating efforts, that would be helpful. So I would just suggest that we continue thinking about that. But let me assure you that this input is very helpful to the process in the IAASB as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Arnold. Denny?
Yes, I support the focus groups, too. I'd like to build on something that Barbara Roper said, and she referred to the survey data. Yesterday, there was a little dialogue. I think Sam asked questions about who are the people in the survey that was referred to. And I would just like to remind us that directors of corporations are shareholders. They are the actual investors in corporations. They are the owners of the business. They are the people that are quite interested in using the financial statements, too. So let's not leave them out of the equation. They are direct users of the financial statements, and they belong in these focus groups as well.
Galen Hansen.
I'll be on the bandwagon here. If we can broaden the focus even wider. One of the things that I hear is when we're talking about this is we're talking about public companies, and to the extent possible, it'd be great if we could minimize the differences between that and the private company reporting, governmental reporting, nonprofit reporting. Do we really need different reports to handle each one of those? That part of this spectrum, to the extent that we can, and we could sync up the language between all of these various bodies, I think it would be helpful to the practitioners.
Thank you. Paul Sobel?
We seem to be focusing primarily on communications between the auditor and investors. Let's not forget that audit committees could also facilitate some of that communication with the possible expansion of an audit committee report included in a document that's filed, and then the independent auditors might only need to verify or indicate some agreement. I mention this because in terms of the focus groups, similar to what Denny was saying, we need to make sure that we don't exclude that audit committee, whether it's NACD, Audit Committee Institute, or whatever, that element from the focus group.
Keeping in mind, of course, that the content of the audit committee report, if you're referring to that, or the audit committee communications and proxy, is outside of the jurisdiction of the PCOB, of course, right?
Yeah, I understand that, and it goes back to what certainly was discussed in Group C, that this would probably need to be a joint effort that would include the SEC and FASB as well. But you presumably would rather do it as a single focus group that all three can benefit from as opposed to three separate focus groups.
Jim Cox.
I actually have a great deal of nervousness about that suggestion, and because I'm not really quite sure how that would work. I mean, I know it's beyond the jurisdiction of this committee, so maybe I don't even have to waste any more words on it here, but since you raised it, I fear that report would then be ultimately drafted by the general counsel's office or the counsel that reports to the CEO. And it would really jeopardize a lot of what we've been trying to accomplish in the last decade, which is enhancing the independence of the audit committee. And if they have to draft a report and then they have to look to the lawyers provided and legal staff and other support staff provided by the executive wing of the company, yeah, I think we've done something of a 180-degree turn here. So I want to be careful when we go down that road. And then you say, well, okay, well, no, we don't have to do that. We'll let them have their own independent counsels going to do this. Then we've driven up the cost, and we all ought to be putting on a flak uniforms at that point because we don't want to do that, okay?
Thank you, Jim. Mary Morris?
I just want to make sure that I still think that there is a little bit of a disconnect. And I think that I do agree, though, that there should be better assurance with adding the language to the opinion. But I also agree that we definitely need this focus group and including all the different groups to discuss it. But I think that I don't know if I necessarily heard that an addendum or auditor's discussion analysis is still needed. And I think from the investor's perspective, I think we do want to know where are the high risks, where are those things, because as an investor, I think we are capital providers. We think that the audit committee, auditors, management is stewards of our capital. So I think it's really important that there be some kind of additional language, because we're looking to the auditors for that opinion. So thank you.
I think we've heard that loud and clear, and that
I think there's general, I can't say general support, a lot of support for the idea of a focus group and to bring together investors and auditors, preparers, the board, and to really try to figure out a way to solve this issue that, you know, investors have been calling for. So I think we've heard that. What I've also heard, though, is some idea of maybe there's two parts to the project, the simpler part of dealing with the language and the communication of the opinion, and then how to solve the investors' needs on these other issues they want to hear about. So we've heard that message, I think, several times. Thanks. Thank you.
Jim Dalkin.
Marty, I'm going to somewhat echo what you just said, but I think you have to remember that the report is really a communications tool, and a number of the issues that have been brought up, I think, really go beyond the nature of the report. They could be disclosure issues. They could be a lack of information that investors say they need, but I don't know that that would be solved through the report. So I think you might want to step back and look at those factors before you move forward.
Thank you. Good comment.